It got up and followed Helena to the door, leaving her cane behind, because there was a chance it was someone she didn't know, and she never liked to give a first impression of being feeble. When Helena opened the front door, Margaret felt slightly woozy, strange memories coming to her, memories of the last time he'd stood on her porch like this. For a moment, she could even feel how blurry and medicated she'd been, how completely, profoundly unhappy she'd felt. "Raleigh Pelham," she said, giving a smart, nervous pull to the hem of her yellow suit jacket. "What on earth are you doing here?" Raleigh turned to Helena. "Please tell Mrs. Serini that her daughter called me a few minutes ago, and I promised I would take Mrs. Serini to her luncheon." "Josie called you?" she asked, followed immediately by an incredulous, "She made you promise?" Pelhams didn't make promises easily, because they knew they couldn't break them. It was astounding that Raleigh had not only promised something, but promised to do something for her. He hated her. "Please tell Mrs. Serini yes," he said to Helena. Helena looked confused and vaguely panicked, obviously wondering why this man wouldn't talk directly to Margaret. Well, there wasn't really any choice now. If Raleigh promised, he had to do it. He would take her to this luncheon, whether she liked it or not, or die trying. Livia Linley White was going to have a fit. "Helena, get my coat and cane, and tell Josie I want a word with her when I get home." Raleigh walked with her to his cab in the windy noon air. She wondered if the neighborhood was watching. She tried to walk as if she didn't care, but she felt herself leaning toward him as if he had a gravitational force. She'd made her decision. She lived with it. But staying away from him was easier when she didn't actually have to be near him. He opened the cab door for her, his face without expression. That also made it easier, knowing how much he disliked her. She awkwardly sat, and he closed the door. When he got behind the wheel and pulled out, she couldn't help but wonder over how familiar this was. It felt like soft slippers, like good wine. She'd fallen into the best part of her past. She stared at the back of his head. She'd always been attracted to Raleigh from the moment she saw him. Ladies in their circle never drove themselves anywhere. They had chauffeurs, or they called a cab. The first time she saw him, she was in her late 20s at the time, he was helping one of her friends out of his cab at a social function. She'd asked, "Who is that?" All the ladies who were natives of Bald Slope knew Raleigh, and they were more than glad to tell her. He was beneath them, but so pretty to look at, with his healthy good looks, blue eyes, and russet hair. After high school, he'd gone into the service. He'd just come back to Bald Slope to work for his father at Pelham Cabs. He met her eyes that day, and it was the start of 3 years of long looks, 3 years of her dismissing the chauffeur for the day, then suddenly realizing she had to go somewhere, so of course she had to call a cab. And it was always Raleigh who came. She never had to ask for him by name. It was so innocent at first. He talked with her, laughed with her. She'd lived for those rides. She was lonely, and he was kind, good-natured and gangly with youth. She knew she should have been more responsible. She was older than Raleigh by almost 8 years after all, but she hadn't meant to get so close to him, not intimate anyway. Then it happened. Raleigh had driven Margaret home on the evening of Christmas Eve after the church program. All the servants were gone for the holiday, and the house was as dark as a hole. They'd had a bevy of help back then. Full-time cook, maid, gardener, chauffeur. But not even Marco was home. By that time, she'd known about his other women. The first time, she'd been devastated. The second didn't hurt as much. By his 10th affair, she was numb. She'd looked up at the house that night and felt empty. She hadn't talked to her family in Asheville since she'd left almost 10 years ago. Her father was a hard man who'd clung to his old southern name. His family lost all their money in the market crash, but they never lost their pride. Margaret was his oldest of 7 daughters, and she took care of her loud, needy sisters after her mother died giving birth to the last one. She cleaned the house from day to night and kept their clothes stitched and fine, because her father wanted to give the illusion to all who knew them that they could afford servants. Even working as hard as she did, her father expected her to keep her appearance impeccable, because he said her beauty was his only thing of value. She thought he meant he valued her, and that was the only thing that kept her going. Later, when he brought Marco to dinner, when he forced Margaret to sit next to Marco at the table, then had her younger sisters serve them drinks on the veranda and leave them alone, she understood. All she was to him was an investment. And as soon as all her sisters were out of the baby stage and able to care for themselves, he'd basically sold her to the man who offered the most. After that, she couldn't wait to get away. Raleigh had opened the door for her and she'd stepped out. She remembered it had been a mild winter. The grass was still green.
"Good night, Mrs. Serini," he'd said. "Have a joyous Christmas."
"Good night," was all she'd managed before her voice broke. She tried to hurry away, but Raleigh caught her hand. She was wearing her red swing coat with the high funnel collar, a red pillbox hat, and white gloves. She'd looked beautiful, young and stylish. She still had that outfit tucked away in the attic. Later, for years after it ended, she would go up and put it on when Marco wasn't home.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing. Please let go of my hand. The neighbors will see."
"There's no one around. Tell me what's wrong."
"Nothing. I must be tired, that's all." Then, before she knew it, she was crying, bawling. She couldn't control it. She couldn't remember the last time she'd cried, and she was appalled at herself for doing so now. Raleigh had taken her into his arms. Oh, it had felt so good, just to be held. He was gentle with her, obviously not wanting to hurt her or scare her, because she was so small and he was so big and inexperienced. She'd wept for a long time, until at last there were no more tears. She quieted and stilled completely, shocked to find herself in his arms, and then afraid to move because she didn't want him to let go.
"Better?" he'd asked,
and she heard his words in his chest, her ear to his heart. She looked up at him and nodded. They'd stared at each other for a long time. He slowly lowered his head, slowly enough for her to pull away if she'd wanted to. She should have. She was Marco Serini's beautiful ice queen wife. He was the naive blue-collar son of the man who owned the local cab company. But for all those reasons, and hundreds more, she didn't move. His lips finally touched hers, and she suddenly felt alive, melting slowly. She never would have known if it weren't for Raleigh. She never would have felt her own heart. He'd shown her she actually had one. And in return, she'd broken his. She felt a cold gush of air and snapped out of it to see that they'd stopped in front of the newly renovated downtown inn where the luncheon was being held. Raleigh was holding the cab door open for her. She looked up at him, the wind blowing his hair, his jacket collar flapping. She felt strangely content, like she felt when she would sometimes dream of him. There would still be Livia Lindley White to deal with, but she decided to forgive Josie, just this once. Raleigh slowly extended his hand to help her out, and with a deep breath, she touched him for the first time in 40 years. The next afternoon, mail in hand, Adam walked up the steps to the Serini's porch. It was finally snowing. He'd felt it coming for days. He always could. He loved when it snowed. At least he used to. These days it was more like a memory of happiness. He used to believe good things happened in this kind of weather, but that was before he almost died one snowy day. He deliberately lost touch with the man he used to be. That man was foolish and careless. The man he was today was safe and calm. This was his second chance to live. This was the life he was supposed to lead now. It didn't always feel like living, though. But that was the old Adam talking. He put the mail in the Serenis box and waited for Josie to appear. When she didn't, he frowned and rubbed his forehead. This was ridiculous. So he knew she loved him. He still wanted to see her. He didn't want things to change. Without another thought, he knocked on the door. A small, pretty woman with caramel-colored skin opened the door. She looked at him curiously. "Mail?" she asked. "Oh, right." He reached over to the mailbox and took out the mail. Then he held it up to show her. He felt like an idiot. "Is Josie here?" "Oldsie?" "No, Josie." "It's okay, Helena. I'll take care of this," Josie said, suddenly appearing behind her. Helena skittered away, leaving Josie there in the doorway, staring at him guardedly. But then her eyes slid past him, and she smiled. "It's finally snowing," she said, opening the screen door. "I've been waiting for this for days." She went to the porch railing and stuck her hand out, the rainy snow pooling on her palm. She loved snow. That was strange. He knew she loved snow. He knew that from 3 years of coming to her door. "It's so beautiful."
"It's going to be deep. Great for snowmen," he said as he came to stand beside her. She laughed as if the thought had never occurred to her. "I've never made a snowman." "No?" She shook her head. "It's a neighborhood rule."
He was staring at her now, at her dark, shiny curls, and her skin so fair it looked like cold, fresh cream.
"You don't have to avoid me, Josie," he said. "There's no reason for it."
She stared straight ahead, watching the snow. She'd gone very still.
"We're okay. I like what we have," he continued.
"Yes, I'm sure you do."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Nothing."
"No, I want to know."
"It means, Adam, that you get to be the object of someone's affection. I don't."
She suddenly waved her hands as if to erase what she'd said from the air.
"Oh, God," she said, turning to him.
"Forget I said that, please." He couldn't help but smile.
"Listen, while you're here, I want to talk to you about Chloe," she said, changing the subject in a flash. He nodded, encouraging her to talk, to interact, anything to keep her from running away.
"Okay?"
"The reason Chloe keeps seeing this Julian person is because he's telling her he knows who Jake slept with."
"Damn," Adam said, surprised. "I'll let Jake know."
"No, please don't tell him," she said. "Just see if you can find out who it is, okay?
I'm not trying to butt into their relationship. I'm just trying to keep her from seeing Julian again. He's hurt someone else I know. I don't want him to do it again."
She'd never asked him for anything. How could he say no? He handed her the mail.
"I'll see what I can do."
"Thanks." He watched her walk to her door. "You get to be the object of someone's affection. I don't."
"Josie?" he suddenly said.
She turned. He hesitated. "Don't change things."
"Have a nice Thanksgiving."
"You too, Adam."
At first, the snow was light and mixed with rain like confetti, white and silver, at an anniversary party. It was not enough, Margaret decided, to keep her from her hair appointment that afternoon. Thanksgiving was a day away, and this was the last opportunity to get her hair done before the start of the tedious Christmas social season. Her holiday wardrobe from Wiseman and Farrow had arrived by express courier earlier that week. She used to have Josie drive her into Asheville twice a year for clothes from the old exclusive shop. But after Margaret broke her hip, Mrs. Farrow's granddaughter came up and took her measurements. She was proud to say she was as trim as she was 40 years ago, and the shop sent her clothes twice a year now, at springtime and Christmas time. This year for the holiday, they'd sent brilliant reds and tasteful golds, and blues the color of her eyes, she would always be the best-dressed woman in Bald Slope. There were a lot of things about her body she couldn't control, her unpredictable bones, her papery skin, but a nice wardrobe and beautiful hair, that she had some power over. Even Livia Lindley White said she was still a beauty. Not that she meant it as a compliment.
"I want you to go to the grocery store while I have my hair done," Margaret said as Josie drove her to the salon, after some quibbling that was very unlike Josie.
"The snow is going to be deep," Josie had said. "We don't want to get stuck. Why don't you wait to have your hair done?"
"Wait," she'd said, like it wasn't important.
"Maybe I should stay with you," Josie said, her eyes on the road. "The snow is going to get heavier, and I might not be able to get back to you."
"Don't be silly. Go to the store. I made a list."
Margaret snapped open her purse and put the list on the dashboard. "Since Helena has the day off tomorrow, I want pastries for breakfast, a sandwich and apple chips for lunch, and a salad for dinner. That should be easy enough for you to prepare."
Josie sighed, just a puff of air, like she was trying to see her breath in the cold.
"It's the day before Thanksgiving, and it's snowing. The grocery store will be a madhouse."
Margaret stared at Josie's profile. Something was changing with Josie, and Margaret didn't like it at all. She was spending more time out with her errands. She would not tell Margaret who her friend was. She was expressing opinions much more freely. It was almost as if she'd been practicing, like someone had been giving her lessons.
"Josie," Margaret said.
"Yes, Mother."
"You are going to the grocery store, and you are going to get everything on my list."
"Of course I am, Mother," Josie said, sounding surprised. "Was there ever any question?"
That was the problem. There was. There suddenly was.
When Margaret entered the salon, she was relieved to see that Annabel Drake was there. That meant Raleigh had already dropped her off and left. Annabel was a nice enough woman, but she was one of those women who couldn't do anything alone. She never went to the beauty salon without checking to see if four other people she knew were going to be there. She had breakfast with her eldest daughter, she had lunch with her youngest, she had dinner with her middle child, the son, every single day. She didn't trust herself to do anything alone. This was, Margaret figured, in large part due to her late husband, Don, a successful doctor and all-around louse. He'd told Annabel that she was incapable so many times that it had sunk into her marrow. Margaret wondered if Raleigh found Annabel's vulnerability attractive.
"Margaret, you have such beautiful hair," Annabel said, when Margaret was seated in the stylist chair beside her.
"Thank you." Longer hair like hers, almost touching her shoulders, with several shades of blonde highlights painted into her gray, was hard to maintain at her age, but she wasn't going to let her hair go steely and get a perm like Annabel.
"And those shoes are just darling."
"I had them specially made," she said, sticking her foot out so everyone could see. She was beautiful. She was more beautiful than Annabel, and she had more money. The salon was busy, the air swimming with plans and rumors and favorite Thanksgiving recipes. It took longer than it usually did for her hairdresser to finish with her hair. Then Margaret had to wait for the manicurist. It was all very inconvenient, and her hip was now aching, but she was generous with her tips anyway. She wanted to be well thought of, and it was always easier to be generous with people you didn't know well. Afterward, she went to the reception area, expecting to see Josie waiting for her. But Josie wasn't there. Margaret had just walked up to the receptionist's desk to ask if her daughter had called or been by when the bell over the door rang. Relieved that Josie was now there, she felt free to be angry with her for not being there when she was supposed to be. But when she turned, it wasn't Josie she saw. It was Raleigh Pelham. His jacket and moleskin driving cap were covered in snow, and he took a moment to brush them off before he walked farther in.
For a moment it was like he was shaking dust off, as if he'd just come out of storage.
"Mrs. Drake will be finished in just a few minutes," the receptionist told Raleigh.
"You say that every time," Raleigh said with a wink. "I get here later and later each visit, and still I wait."
"Would you like a cup of coffee?"
He took a seat on one of the couches.
"That would be nice, thank you."
The receptionist went to get his coffee, leaving Raleigh and Margaret to stare at each other. He was in his mid-60s now, his hair silver. She'd noticed just this past summer, however, that when he stood in the sun, glints of auburn still shone through. The young man she once knew wasn't all gone.
"Talk to me," she thought. "Say something."
When the receptionist came back and handed Raleigh a cup of coffee, Margaret finally turned away and headed to the ladies' room, where she intended to hide until Raleigh left. The phone rang as she was walking away. The receptionist said a few words into the receiver, then called,
"Wait, Mrs. Serini, your daughter is on the phone."
Margaret hastily walked back and took the phone.
"Josie, are you all right? Why aren't you here?"
"I'm just leaving the grocery store," Josie said, sounding tense. "It's going to take a while to get there."
"Why?"
"Because the roads are terrible and there's a ton of traffic. The grocery store was packed."
"I don't understand you, Josie. Are you doing this on purpose?"
"Why would I do this on purpose, Mother?" Raleigh stood and walked to the desk. He set his coffee cup down.
"Will you ask Mrs. Serini if I could speak to her daughter?" he said to the receptionist, though he was looking at Margaret.
"Mrs. Serini?"
the receptionist started to say.
"Why do you want to speak to my daughter?"
Margaret asked him. He took a few steps to her and gently took the phone away from her. She leaned in slightly, but he didn't quite touch her. Almost, though.
"Josie, it's Raleigh Pelham. Where are you?" he said into the receiver, watching Margaret the entire time. "I see. You'll never make it here, not in that car. Go home and be careful. I'm here to pick up Annabel Drake, and it would be no problem at all to drop your mother off at your house. I have chains on my tires."
Pause.
"You're very welcome. Remember, be careful."
"I can't believe you just did that," Margaret said, as he handed the receiver back to the receptionist. "Why are the two of you suddenly in cahoots? Did you ever think to ask me if that was what I wanted?"
As soon as she said it, as soon as she saw the look on his face, she knew how hypocritical it sounded, considering what had happened between the two of them. Raleigh turned to Annabel, who had just appeared at Margaret's side. Margaret smelled her perm before she saw her.
"Annabel, will you help Mrs. Serini outside when I pull the cab up to the front door? Josie can't make it here in this snow."
"I don't want you to take me home," Margaret said desperately. "You don't even like me."
"Don't you agree, Annabel, that Josie would never make it from the market to here and back to the Serini's neighborhood in this weather?"
"He's right, Margaret," Annabel said, patting her on the arm. "Come with us. You'll be our chaperone. There's a rumor going around about me and Raleigh, you know, because we spend so much time together in his cab."
Margaret watched him walk outside and disappear into the heavy veil of snow.
"Yes, I know."
It had ended at a summer party Marco had thrown. Marco threw the best parties. Everyone clamored for an invitation. This particular party was island-themed, complete with a tiki bar in the backyard, paper lanterns hung in the trees, and waiters who wore white pants and Hawaiian shirts. Each guest was even given a lei. Marco had taken care of everything. He never let Margaret plan their parties. All she had to do was look beautiful. Livia Lindley White wore a god-awful muumuu to the party. Her dark hair was just beginning to go white, and her bouffant looked like a dirty cotton ball. She watched Margaret at the party. She always watched her, and that's how she eventually found out. Margaret had been seeing Raleigh secretly for over a year now, and she was getting careless. The time she spent with him was never enough, and she had started making mistakes in her desperation to be with him. It was dusk, and Mrs. Langdon Merriweather was ready to leave, so Margaret went inside to call for a cab. The older guests liked to leave early, because Marco's parties grew famously rowdy after dark, when Marco brought out his good liquor. Margaret knew it was Raleigh coming to pick up Mrs. Merriweather, so she made an excuse to stay in the house, near the front windows, to watch for him. She wanted him to see her in her outfit, in her sarong and sandals, and her tight sleeveless button-down tied at her waist so that a strip of skin at her stomach showed. She saw him drive by the house. There wasn't any place to park in front of the house because of the party, so he had to park down the block. She left and met him halfway, on the sidewalk by the boxwoods in the Franklin's front yard. His eyes scraped her body, and he smiled as she walked toward him. "Hello, Raleigh," she said in the voice she always used when they saw each other in public.
"Hello, Mrs. Serini."
"Hot evening, isn't it?"
"It is indeed."
She stopped in front of him on the sidewalk.
"You look incredible," he whispered,
his hands stiff at his sides, as if fighting an irresistible force to lift them, to touch her. She looked over her shoulder. No one knew he was here yet. They had a few moments, so she pulled him into the Franklin's yard behind the boxwoods. The Franklins were at the party. No one would see. They kissed, his big hands going all over her. She loved this about him, how eager he always was, how he let her guide him to all the right places where it felt the best. He made her eager. She thought about him all the time. Her body ached from his absence and sang when he was near. Sometimes this was all they had time for, a fast, passionate encounter. Sometimes, though, she would hire him to take her to Asheville to shop, but they'd stop halfway there and have a picnic on the parkway, and they'd talk all day. He was a good man, earnest and smart. He could have stayed in the army or gone to college, but he came back to help his family with their business. He was their only son. Their joy and pride surrounded him like a halo. When she thought back, she always lingered on that. She'd never known another man like him. His family loved him, and he gave his love so effortlessly. She wanted that. She wanted that to fill her until she was full, but there was never enough time. He'd had her shirt unbuttoned, his mouth trailing down her neck, when they suddenly heard, "Well, well, well." They pulled apart, and Margaret's hands went to her blouse, fumbling with her buttons. "I knew it," Livia said, self-righteousness making her seem 10 feet tall, like she could step on them if she wanted to. "I knew if I just waited long enough, I would find out who you really are. Adulterer, slut, you have shamed Marco Serini and everything he's done for this town." Margaret had known she was doing the wrong thing, but she had not then and still would not apologize for it. A good person would have regretted having an affair, but she'd never claimed to be a good person. Raleigh was, though, and he was better than this.
"Leave Raleigh," Margaret said flatly.
"I'm not leaving you."
"You have no choice."
"No."
She whipped her head around and said, "Raleigh, for the love of God, just go."
When Raleigh left, Margaret very calmly made a deal with Livia behind the boxwoods. Margaret didn't ask Livia not to tell Marco. She just asked that Livia not say it was Raleigh. He was young. He deserved to get on with his life. He didn't deserve the wrath of Marco, and neither did his family. Livia had agreed, because she got the best of both worlds. She got to tell Marco and hold something over Margaret. Marco had been livid, of course. He'd yelled at her, even pushed her against a wall in their bedroom while guests laughed and got drunk outside. It was the first and only time he'd ever hit her. He wanted to know who it was. Livia had been vague. She said she'd seen Margaret with someone, but she couldn't make out who. But Marco couldn't break Margaret, no matter how angry he got. Ice queens didn't break, after all. They melted. And Marco didn't have enough warmth for that. He left her to go back to his guests, demanding she fix her cut lip and join him. He would never trust her again, he said. He would have her followed. He would always know what she was doing. He would not be made to look bad. And he would find out who she had been with. Then he would ruin him. Raleigh came to the door late that night, banging on it. He was going to declare his love for her, and he didn't care who knew it. He was going to take on the great Marco Cerini. Thank God Marco was already passed out upstairs, after hard sex she'd taken Valium to get through. She could remember fragments of what came next. She remembered telling Raleigh that she didn't love him, that she didn't know how to love. She remembered the feel of the ice forming inside again. She told him she was older, she was married, she'd taken advantage of him, he needed to move on. She remembered him begging. She remembered trying not to cry, desperate for him to just go away. She'd found how to give love from somewhere deep inside her, a place she never knew existed. She'd been mad at Raleigh for making her capable of feeling this way. If he hadn't shown her how, she wouldn't be hurting so much. And finally, she remembered watching him walk away. The words, "Please don't leave," stuck in her throat. And to this day, Raleigh had never said another word directly to her. Chapter 10 Mellow Cream Pumpkins. She wanted to do this, Chloe told herself. She made another cup of stinging nettle tea that afternoon, hoping to feel like the decision was the right one. But the only decisions the tea made easier were whether or not to cook a turkey this year, she decided against, and whether or not she should wear a hat if she went out, she decided for. Whether or not she should actually go out with Julian that night was still as murky as the Green Cove River. What to cook and what to wear were not what she needed help with. Maybe Nova hadn't given her a high enough dose of the stuff. Chloe poured the rest of the tea into the sink and watched it swirl down the drain. She was depressed about tomorrow being Thanksgiving. She wouldn't be going to Jake's parents' house this year, and she'd always enjoyed that. She loved seeing what Faith came up with every year, how she would decorate, what her signature libation would be. This was, in fact, going to be Chloe's first Thanksgiving alone. Friends and acquaintances had been calling and leaving messages all day, wishing her a happy holiday. She didn't want to talk to them, didn't want to field their sympathetic offers for her to join in their family celebrations. In fact, the only person she wanted to talk to was Josie, who had called earlier to check up on her. She'd tried calling Josie back, but got her voicemail. That's when Chloe got it in her head to call Julian. She hadn't contacted him since the incident at Nightlight. She should at least apologize, wish him a happy Thanksgiving. And, of course, maybe he would finally give her the name of the woman Jake had slept with. Yesterday, when Josie came over with food, Chloe told her that she was through trying to find out who the other woman was. She even said she was definitely not going to see Julian again. And at the time, she meant it, because Josie was there and that made Chloe feel better. But what seemed like a good idea then felt like a horrible one now. She didn't have a good rein on her emotions, and her own unpredictability scared her. Nothing else was working. If she just found out who it was, then everything would get better. Julian had answered right away, as if he'd been expecting her. "Hi, Julian. This is Chloe. I'm so sorry about Monday."
"You have some crazy friends," he said. Even his censure a seduction, the way it made her feel sorry for him, want to be with him. "My jaw still hurts."
"Why does your jaw hurt?" she asked.
"The big blonde guy hit me."
"Adam hit you?"
She remembered Adam being there,
and Josie had told her it was because Chloe had done some drunk dialing and called him. But Adam? Good-natured Adam had hit him?
You don't remember?
No.
You were pretty hammered, he said, and that seemed to make him feel better.
All is forgiven, sweetheart. Why don't you come over to my place this afternoon? We can spend the holiday together. I'll tell you all about this other woman. I'll even show you where she lives.
But once again, he wouldn't tell Chloe her name over the phone. It was a way to get her to come to him, and she wanted to believe it was because he didn't want to be alone. He was probably depressed about the holiday, too. And what better way for two broken hearts to spend a holiday than spying on one of the people responsible for their heartbreak, right? Later, when Chloe walked outside, the snow was coming down heavier than it had a few hours ago when she closed her shop at noon. She was surprised to see how much of it was on the sidewalk and street. It was a wet, heavy snow, and it already reached her ankles. When she got to her VW Beetle in the parking lot beside the building, she sighed. Cars had come and gone in the lot, pushing snow up against her tires. She tried kicking it out of the way, then she bent and pushed it away with her gloved hands. As she was digging in the snow, she noticed something strange. There, at her back tire, under the snow, was a book. She brushed more snow away and picked it up. Madame Bovary. She rolled her eyes and threw the book into a snowbank. Books thought she was going to cheat on Jake. That was rich. Traffic was mad, the heaviest snow falling just as people were getting off from work early for the holiday, and skiers were on the road to the slopes to take advantage of the first big snowfall. The secondary roads were quieter, so Chloe cut through Summertime Road. She had to take the highway to get to the address Julian had given her, but there was a wreck, and traffic got backed up on the ramp. That's when her little car got stuck. Some people behind her helped her push her Beetle to the shoulder, and she was offered the warm sanctuary of many cars waiting on the ramp, but she declined. The tea hadn't made her decision easier, and the snow had taken away the choice altogether. She felt strangely relieved. Now all she wanted to do was go home. It took Chloe nearly an hour and a half to walk back to Summertime Road. She was shivering with cold, and the snow on the ground was so high now she was forced to adopt a high step that made her thigh muscles burn. Her cheeks were like holly berries, her pink down coat was nearly white with snow, and her favorite UGG boots were thoroughly wet. She finally let herself stop for a breather when she reached the yellow house that had captured her imagination since the day it had gone on the market. She stood there and stared at it so long that her footprints were covered with snow, and it looked like she'd grown there, right out of the sidewalk. She was startled when the door to the house suddenly flew open, and a bald man ran outside to the tiny porch. He was wearing oven mitts and carrying a turkey pan, the turkey inside charred and smoky. He threw the turkey, pan and all, into the snow, where it made a smoke-filled hole. A short woman in her 60s, wearing overalls and bright purple leather high-tops, stood at the door shaking her head. "I told you I smelled something burning," she said to the man. "I followed the directions," he insisted. "You put it on broil. I told you we shouldn't have cooked." Almost simultaneously, they turned, both becoming aware of the person watching them from the sidewalk. "Hello?" the man called, waving an oven mitt at her. "Are you all right?" She snapped out of it. "Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to stare."
"You look like you've been out here a while," the man said. "I thought you were a snowman."
"My car got stuck on the highway. I was walking back home. Sorry about your turkey," she said, and started to trudge toward downtown. Her legs had grown stiff standing there. It hurt to move them.
"You've walked all the way from the highway?" the woman said. "George, help her in here."
George immediately walked down the front steps and into the snow, even though he was wearing Birkenstocks and black socks.
"No, I'm fine,"
she waved to get him to go back. "It's just another couple of blocks."
"You'll get frostbite," the woman called. "And look how heavy the snow is now. George actually looks like he has hair."
By the time he reached her, George's bald pate had a fine layer of snow on it. She was too tired and cold to argue, so she let him lead her inside.
"I'm Zelda Cramden, and this is my husband, George," Zelda said, when she closed the door behind them, and they all stood in the small foyer.
"I know," Chloe said, trying to smile, but her face was frozen. "I've met you at your open houses."
"You know, you do look familiar now that I see you up close," Zelda said, taking off Chloe's wet crocheted cap, then helping her out of her coat. "I remember your red hair."
George took off his Birkenstocks and peeled off his socks.
"What's your name?"
Chloe Finley, she said, trying to get her boots off herself, but Zelda had to help her.
"Come with me, Chloe, and I'll get you some dry clothes," Zelda said, leading her down the hallway. "George, for God's sake, open a window. The smoke is so thick in here you could eat it."
"Ungrateful woman, you should applaud my budding culinary endeavors," George said, walking barefoot to the kitchen. "I'll applaud when you cook something edible."
"Am I interrupting your Thanksgiving preparations?" Chloe asked.
"No, no, our daughter, her husband, and the grandkids were coming in, but they got as far as Asheville and the snow stopped them," Zelda said, showing Chloe into one of the bedrooms that had obviously been made up for her incoming family. There were small touches like a water pitcher and glasses on the nightstand, and a jar of soft peppermints and a stack of folded towels on the bureau. Zelda took one of the towels and handed it to Chloe.
"I thought there was no sense in cooking since it was just going to be the two of us, and I put my feet up to read and watch the snow.
Sounds nice, huh?
Well, that's when George decided to cook his first Thanksgiving dinner ever, hence the black bird in the yard. We're going to miss our daughter entirely this year. They probably won't be able to get out of Asheville until the day after tomorrow, and that's when they have to leave to go back home."
Zelda went through the drawers and brought out a pair of socks, pink sweatpants, and a Yale sweatshirt. This, Chloe guessed, had been their daughter's room.
"I'm sorry your family can't be here," Chloe said, as Zelda put the clothes on the bed.
Zelda shrugged, though Chloe could tell it really did bother her.
"They're staying in a hotel with an indoor pool. The grandkids are in heaven."
Zelda focused on Chloe with her sharp bird eyes.
"Can I share something with you?"
"Of course," Chloe said, rubbing the towel vigorously over her hair.
"Our daughter bought us a house last year near her home in Orlando. She bought it and put it in our names and said, 'When you're ready, come down and live close to your grandkids.' When George and I visited and saw what a lovely house it was, how wonderful the weather was, we thought it was a great idea. We were going to do it. We're retired, and these snows take a toll on us. So we put this house on the market, but we priced it so high that we knew no one would be interested. We thought, if it doesn't sell in a year, it's a sign. We would stay. We weren't really ready to leave, you see. Now a year has gone by, and we've missed the birth of another grandchild, and now Thanksgiving. We need to be closer to them. George and I decided just this afternoon that we have to move. We're lowering the price on the house."
Chloe stopped drying her hair at that startling news. She forced herself to say something, not to just stare at Zelda.
"That must have been a hard decision to make."
"It was. But we made it. Then we said we would wait for a sign that it was the right decision. That's when the smoke alarm went off. Then we opened the door, and there you were."
Zelda turned to the door.
"I'll leave you to change. Just drape your wet clothes over the radiator."
When Zelda left, Chloe peeled off her clothes. Her skin was icy. She felt shivery inside, too, but she wasn't so sure that had to do with the cold. They were lowering the price on this house. Her house. After she'd put on the dry clothes, she left the room. She found George and Zelda speaking in serious tones in the kitchen, which looked like a grocery store had exploded in it. There were packages half open and vegetables half cut all over the countertops. Flour coated the floor. Pots and pans were everywhere. They stopped talking when she entered.
"I'm going to try to salvage what's left in here," Zelda said. "George, show her around."
George led her out of the kitchen.
"You said you've been to our open houses. Do you go to a lot of others?"
"No, just this one. Just this house."
"Do you have a favorite room?" George asked.
"Yes."
"So quickly," she answers. "Which one?"
"The library," she said softly. George smiled.
"My wife's favorite, too. Lead the way."
There was a fire in the fireplace, and it made the dark wood of the ceiling-high built-in bookcases glow. There wasn't an inch of wall space that didn't have a shelf occupied by books. The room felt so complete, so warm. She'd dreamed of this room for weeks after she saw it at their first open house. George sat in the window seat by the bay window and crossed his legs, resting one ankle on the opposite knee. He was now wearing bunny slippers.
"What would you do with this room if it was yours?"
"Nothing," Chloe said as she walked around. "It's perfect as it is. I have books, hundreds of boxes of them. They would all go here."
"You're a reader, hm?"
She stopped, her back to him. She smoothed her hand over the spines of a row of books. "I have a special relationship with books."
"Books can be possessive, can't they? You're walking around in a bookstore, and a certain one will jump out at you, like it had moved there on its own, just to get your attention. Sometimes what's inside will change your life, but sometimes you don't even have to read it. Sometimes it's a comfort just to have a book around. Many of these books haven't even had their spines cracked." "Why do you buy books you don't even read?" our daughter asks us. "That's like asking someone who lives alone why they bought a cat. For company, of course." "Here, come here. I want to show you something."
He stood and led her to the hallway and opened the coat closet. It was packed, absolutely crammed with books.
"Look at this. Howard, our realtor, told us that we had to move all the stacks of books out of the bedrooms and hallway in order to stage the house. He said clutter distracted potential buyers. He called books clutter."
Zelda came out of the kitchen, the warm scent of charred Thanksgiving trailing behind her. She handed Chloe a cup of coffee.
"George, Howard said not to deliberately show people that." "We've got ourselves a reader, Zelda."
"Really?" Zelda said, looking at Chloe thoughtfully.
"Well, you didn't manage to ruin everything in the kitchen, George. Dinner will be ready in a little while. We can talk books, Chloe. How would you like that?"
"I'd like that very much."
"When I first heard your name, I knew it sounded familiar," Zelda said. "I finally remember why. I remember there being a Finley farm off the highway."
"Yes, that was where I grew up.
Whatever happened to it?"
"My great-grandparents raised me. When they got sick, I had to sell it to pay their medical bills."
"That must have been hard for you."
"Giving up a house you love is always hard."
"That," Zelda said, "was the perfect answer."
Josie had turned off all the lamps in her bedroom so she could stand at her window and watch the snow fall in the darkness. But Della Lee wanted the light on in the closet so she could see to cut photos from Josie's travel magazines. She was going to make a collage. It was her new thing. Josie had given up trying to make sense of Della Lee, but she figured it really didn't matter now. As soon as Mr. Lamar's letter came, she would be leaving anyway. It wasn't as comforting a thought as she wanted it to be, mostly because when Della Lee left, Josie wouldn't even have Adam anymore. He said he didn't want things to change, but they already had. She could feel it.
Well, at least with no more distractions, Josie would be able to focus solely on her mother again, and that would make Margaret happy. Margaret had come in after Raleigh had walked her to the door in the snow and had gone directly to her bedroom. She hadn't said a word to Josie, and she'd only talked to Helena once to tell her she would take her dinner in her room. Josie could feel her censure like a slap. She didn't like displeasing her mother, but at the same time she didn't understand how Margaret could blame her for the weather. She wondered how long it would take to live this down. She could imagine for years to come, every time it snowed, Margaret would bring up the time Josie had left her at the salon with no way home. Good times. Good times.
"You have a message on your cell phone from Chloe," Della Lee said from the closet.
Josie turned to her, sitting in a pool of light in the otherwise dark room.
"How do you know that?"
Della Lee shrugged as she carefully cut out a photo of the Eiffel Tower with the scissors she'd filched from Josie's desk drawer.
Josie sighed. "I'd be mad about you using my cell, except I never get messages and I never would have checked."
Josie went to her purse and got her phone. She walked over to the closet, to the light, in order to see the buttons to retrieve the message.
"Who did you call?"
"No one."
"Was it Julian?"
"I didn't call anyone."
"Fine, don't tell me."
Josie retrieved the message and listened as Chloe told her that she was fine, not to worry about her, and that she'd call Josie on Thanksgiving. She didn't sound as bad as yesterday, and Josie was glad. Maybe Chloe was over the rough part now. Josie put her phone back in her purse. Now to take care of her rough part.
"Della Lee," she said, turning to her, "I think we need to talk about what you're going to do when Mr. Lamar's letter arrives. You don't have much time, so you need to start planning. I'd like to think that going through all my travel magazines is a good sign. Do you want to travel?"
Della Lee pointed to the stack of magazines she'd brought out of the secret closet and set beside her.
"Obviously not as much as you do."
"You're going to have to leave. You promised."
Della Lee made a happy sound when she found a photo of the Arc de Triomphe. She began to cut it out. Apparently, Paris was going to be an important part of her collage. Josie had always dreamed of going to Paris.
"I've got to get you settled, then I'll go."
"But I am settled," Josie insisted. "So we're back to figuring out where you're going when you leave."
"It's all planned," Della Lee said. This was news to Josie.
"It is?"
"Of course. I knew where I was going the minute I left my house."
The minute she left her house. The minute she left behind her childhood with a troubled mother. The minute she left behind her criminal record. The minute she left behind Julian. She left her entire life. How did she do that? Josie had only dreamed of that kind of gumption.
"Then where are you going? Tell me all about it."
"I told you, north."
"But where north?"
"I don't have to tell you everything," Della Lee said.
"And really, it's none of your business anyway."
Typical Della Lee.